Welcome to Holyrood Ungagged, the Tina Turner of political podcasts, season 5, episode 9. I'm Neil Anderson, broadcasting from the neglected north of Glasgow, and with me this evening is... Who's going first? Kat, you go first, here you.
Hello, I am Kat Carey. I spent the weekend in Glasgow myself. And currently enjoying the sunny Edinburgh evening.
Right. And our third person is...
It's Brian Finlay.
I decided I wasn't doing the introductions. I thought I'd let you do it yourself.
That's fair. It is also stunning here in Falkirk. It hit 24 degrees today. It is warm and lovely.
Yeah, well, it is Scotland, so we've got to make the best of it when we can.
True. Just
make sure you don't end up like a lobster.
Back to 50 all round.
So in the sunshine of the weekend, did you get anything special done?
Well, I attended the Out for Indie, which is the LGBT wing of the SNP. I attended their conference, fun fact. Heterosexuals are welcome to come and support. So that I was there as an ally. So I got to listen to the conference motions they put forward, a lot to be excited about, recognition of intersex people, sex workers' rights, and a whole host of other things that are great. I think one of them is about, what do you call it when you have somebody else have your baby?
Surrogacy
for same. There we go. Same-sex couples. So I'm actually really looking forward to being an ally and taking some of them forward to my branch and other branches and trying to get some more support for the fall conference.
We love an ally. My weekend was pretty chill, mostly gardening, chilling out, walks, nice things, and I was also working quite a bit as well. So busy weekend. But last night I went to see The Little Mermaid. And it was very, very enjoyable. I went with some friends from school, and it was a really nice evening. I was a bit apprehensive. You got to get Ursula right. It was something that I was concerned about, but no, it delivered. So if you're feeling apprehensive about going to see it, just do it. It's very well done.
Excellent. Well, I didn't do much myself. A bit of preparing. I have a week tomorrow. And then for hip replacement operation. So kind of starting to try and think of what I need to do. And I've been doing a bit of cooking and stick it in the freezer and stuff like that. But that was about it. Quite weekend. Okay.
Glad to hear that you're getting your surgery.
Yes. Thank you.
I'm sure all will go well and best wishes and positive healing powers.
Thank you very much. Right, well, in that case, let's get ungagged. Now, the first of our four topics taking this evening is maybe the darkest one that we have, so we can do that and then we can move on. But it is extremely important. Last week, Scotland's Chief Constable, Sir Ian Livingstone, who is retiring, said that Police Scotland is institutionally racist, and also included in there is sexist and homophobic. And misogyny was happening as well. So there's first-hand racism, sexism and homophobia, and including staff being punished for raising concerns about any of that. So there has been a wee bit of backlash from police officers via whatever organisation. But he did say that, you know, it didn't mean that individual officers were any of those things. But if your institution is racist, it comes from the people that are in it, doesn't it? And several things have come up after that. or reported again. Like the one I noticed, there was a former firearms officer, Rona Malone, who won almost £1 million in compensation after tribunal agreed that she'd been victimised after she'd raised concerns on sexism. So that's not good. And then, of course, the other thing that is ongoing at the moment, taking that into account of that, is the continuing inquiry into the death of Sheku Bayou. And part of that investigation, if to find out, is if race was a factor.
So it's kind of nuts that they need a tribunal to figure that one out.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I suppose, maybe what happens when you get institutions. If if something is that kind of an institution, and they want to dismiss it, that you need something as big as that to turn around and find out, and hopefully, you get the resolution that you want, and that's found out. But how many other things have gone on like that with all those different types of discrimination going on?
Well, I guess what I would say here is that we live in a institutionally racist society, and the prevalence of things like the delay in the Sheku Bayou trial and the prevalence of the people getting angry at the outgoing chief constable's comments is just shows the resistance to like making amends. I will say, far be it for me to defend police, but his replacement has said that it was a good thing he said it, that he has a base to build on, and then he can make progress. So, at least the new boss is not saying, no, no way in our force. You know, it's not just racism, it's misogyny, it's xenophobia, it's homophobia, it's ableism. Our society is built for cishet, straight, able, white men. And, that's just not the reality. So every step we can take to call it out, and good on Ian Livingston for being a person of power, calling it out. Because there's just far too many examples for me to even try and find a few to list, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I would absolutely echo that. I think Police Scotland is not detached from society, therefore it falls in with the realms of the norms and the prejudices held by society at large. So I would be shocked if the Police Scotland was to be found not to be racist, homophobic, misogynist, and showing prejudice to a variety of minorities. I think Ian Livingston's choice to say it as he's departing whilst he's been in charge of Police Scotland for basically its whole of its existence, I think is interesting. I think that, Ian Livingston perhaps might have had more credence if he had done this beforehand and then put a plan in place, a public relations exercise, not in a sort of a naff sense, but to build trust with the people of Scotland. This is one step forward in terms of where we are with the Metropolitan Police. I mean, that was a report that came out, I think it was about 4 or 5 months ago now, where the lead of the Metropolitan Police would not use this term of institutionally racist, misogyny, and homophobic. But to be honest, when we start talking about the language and stuff, it's less important. It's more the impact on people who have been policed. My view in general is that the policing as it stands at the moment cannot truly be an inclusive and supportive institution. I think a lot of these powerful institutions that we have in Scotland, right across the UK, I think have been created by design to control working class communities, minorities, things like that. So I'm not sure that a policing as it stands at the moment could ever be truly inclusive or part of liberation for minorities. And this has really sadly been illustrated by the Shacklebio inquiry, because we are, you know, the Shacklebio's death was in 2015. It's now 2023, and we've got discussions happening around, well, was race, you know, a contributing factor to his death? And I just, it's just extremely frustrating. And I think that if we turn to society at large and how people feel about policing, you only need to speak to minorities and how comfortable they feel about coming forward and reporting hate crimes. And you even need to look at the employees of Police Scotland, the example you gave of Rona, that even they don't have trust in the institution. So my opinion is that policing as it stands is not fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. It's used as a control mechanism. It's used to police minorities and the working class, you know, unfavorably. And we really need to turn to other radical forms of how we should adopt policing as we know it right now.
And that's what, this is maybe an anecdotal or whatever cultural sort of thought about that. When I was younger, and this name had existed for a long while, sort of police vans that put people in the back of them were known as paddy wagons, right? And that would have come from that oppression of working class people, and at the time, presumably, time of canals and railways and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then somebody deciding that the Irish, although they were doing some work to get a railway, they were causing too much trouble, and the Polish just went and got them and stuffed them all in the back of a wagon. You know, so that's...
I never really put it together that that's what that came from.
I haven't researched it, but I always kind of assumed that because it was full of paddies.
It makes sense. I wonder, is that a British term first? Because they call them paddy wagons in America too, yeah. So that's interesting.
Mind you, maybe that could be the other way around, because there's a lot of Irish policemen in America by sort of.
Yes, the Irish were also shit on in America.
Massively. Yeah, and every single minority, every single group in society, anyone who's a working class person will have likely have had similar encounters with the police, or awarenesses of the police, or their own preconceived ideas of the police. And these types of things don't come out of nowhere. You know, if it comes to people not trusting the criminal justice system more broadly. And, you know, when you look at some of the stats as well, when you look at convictions for sexual assault, rape, you know, hate crimes, all these different things, and by the time it goes through the long processes of reporting to sentencing, it's really understandable why so many groups in society do not either trust the police or feel that they can go and get the support that they deserve from a policing system. And really now, it's almost like with Ian Livingston leaving the police force and saying this, it's, you know, it's almost like trying to come out with it before he leaves, and then there is a massive, you know, inquiry or report into how things are, and then it would be reflected on him. He's, you know, trying to do the trying to be ahead and trying to communicate this to the public. But if you ask anybody from these groups, I think people already know. And if it's a surprise to you, you probably are a white, able-bodied, cis white man.
Yeah, well, I am that, and I don't know what it might be described as woke, I suppose is the phrase, but I don't know if amazed is the right word, but, you know, I try my best to think of things from different people's perspectives, but sometimes when you hear about things like that, you go, no, right, not rich, never have been, but family's never been greatly poor. And I haven't had the problems that women have had, and the, you know, immigrant workers and LGBT. And I haven't had that. And I only know about it from other people's perspective.
Yeah.
Because I just sailed through because of that stereotype that I am that you just mentioned. You know? Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing, you know, if we home in, you know, on queerphobia, homophobia, that the police was a mechanism used to try and oppress the liberation of the queer movement, you know, going back to the Stonewall riots in America and the different riots that would have happened here, and then the developments and still the protests that happen, that the policing is there to clamp down on that. We've seen extreme cases, you know, right, is going back to the coronation, you know, all of these different things. It's about constant it's oppression, in my opinion, of minorities and the expression and resistance of those groups. And the policing is central to that. And until that changes, and until the trust of these minorities are with whatever institution would replace policing, then any state apparatus that's aimed to carry out criminal justice, and I say that in inverted commas, then we will never move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And Police Scotland is obviously just as representative of that as the Metropolitan Police, which has had a lot of media coverage over the past 6 months particularly.
But think about the institutions, and certainly current and previous governments as well, but current government, the things that they're wanting to restrict trade unions even more, the laws that are brought in for restricting protest as well are even tougher. And that's now you got campaign for stopping oil are now doing their slow walking in London because they would just be arrested doing anything else. And that's just stopping protests from any group. It doesn't have to be somebody that's possibly causing a lot of public disruption. It's anybody who wants to complain about what's happening to them in their life.
Or carrying cable ties, apparently, where they could be locked, you know, as a locking on, device. It's just, and we're also entering the stage of that preemptive policing. So, you know, or you potentially could cause a problem, so we're going to arrest you now and, you know, hold you as well the coronation takes place. You know, I think that's one of the most illustrative examples of that. Public order bill.
More than a little bit authoritarian. We've passed the entering into authoritarianism. We are like not mid, but I would say lightly and speedily progressing to full-on authoritarianism. Just like, you know, Scotland wasn't supposed to be included in these anti-strike laws, in these protest laws, and the UK government decided, no, you are in it. So I just was listening to a cracker of a member's business debate, which are usually the debates that nobody attends or listens to at Parliament. And tonight there was one on devolution, and it was pretty impressive. Some big names from the back benches. John Swinney spoke. It was Keith Brown's motion. Maggie Chapman spoke. Of course, she was brilliant. And actually, I thought Jamie Hepburn was pretty good to sum up. That's going a little bit off topic, but all these things that we can do to improve life for people in Scotland is being just taken out one by one. Maybe this is a good transition into our next.
It's a great transition.
Yes, I was just thinking that as well.
You are welcome.
Yeah, because one of the other topics is looking at what has happened to the Scottish bill on the deposit return scheme. And just quick introduction, in case there's folk that don't know, was for returning single-use containers, drinks containers, and the wide range. There was glass, there was plastics that could be done, etc. And Scotland applied for
it's the exemption to the Internal Markets Act.
That's it, yes. Uh-huh. And the Westminster government has come back and said, yes, you can go ahead, but it's taken out the biggest part of it, really, is not allowing glass to be done. Whereas Wales has got a scheme that still includes glass, but they didn't apply for the exemption, so they can keep their glass. So if that's not part of an overall controlling mechanism, added to what you were saying earlier, I mean, to me, that is particularly blatant.
I mean, I think that they are trying to kind of nix Wales as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think that one's going ahead. No. But it just kind of shows. And tonight at the debate, someone, I can't remember who said, oh, I think it was Keith Brown said something about how Mark Drakeford was the loudest voice of Labour for Scottish or any devolution. There was like a few Labour people in the chamber, but, you know, the stronger voices for that can't always make these debates. And it was, you know, it is sad because Labour, isn't Labour the party of devolution? And they're looking at being in government, so they don't want to rock the boat. And it's just utterly cowardly.
Yeah, Donald Dewart that was the main sort of thrust behind getting it all done and through.
Mm-hmm. But like turning to the DRS, more specifically, just one kind of honourable mention here was Ash Denham's leadership campaign with a picture of the DRS with the recycle bin, which is like, you know, bin the DRS. It was one of the highlights of the SNP leadership. Which was obviously grim.
And it looked like she was throwing doctors in the bin.
yes, absolutely. But this news did actually come as a bit of a surprise to me, not because the glass wasn't included, it's the fact that it was allowed to go ahead, because I think all indications beforehand was that they were going to block it altogether. So the UK government was going to block because of the Internal Markets Act. There were concerns about putting more barriers to trade between Scotland and the rest of the UK. So when it was actually passed, I was like, oh, and then I was like, oh. So I think the DRS obviously has been in the works for quite some time, a little bit too long for my liking. I think it's up to 7 years. Am I right in saying 7 years? Something like that. So this was already, you know, the wheels were already turning on this before Brexit. The Internal Markets Act, I think it's 2021, was out of the UK's withdrawal from the EU. And then, of course, there was a lot of accusations thrown around. I think it was more to paint Lorna Slater as being a really incompetent minister, that there wasn't engagements with the UK government, there wasn't the requests, etc., etc. However, the Scottish government refutes that. So, you know, there is that. But is the fact that when it comes to devolved competencies, which we're all very clear that the DRS falls very comfortably within, that even we're starting to see the kind of arm of the UK government blocking certain things. We've seen it with the GRR bill, we've seen it with the deposit return scheme. And that is not surprising at all, because newsflash, Tories didn't want devolution, and the Tories like to see centralised power, and they like to see as little barriers as possible to trade. So this is where the Internal Markets Act really is being exposed for what it is, and it's actually reaching into devolved areas. So it's a blatant attack on devolution. And for those who sounded the alarm with the GRA bill, you know, this is just the start. And of course, the Tories chose that, the GRA bill, because it was apparently, you know, contentious or whatever you want to call it. But it's now starting to seep into to different policy areas, and it's now commonplace for UK government ministers to openly criticise devolved legislation publicly before it's been passed. And it's almost like, well, we won't allow that. And this is not surprising. It's been a very, very slow journey to this point, because devolution is generally very popular. And I think what the Tories are trying to do is weaponize their sort of goal of a centralized state, and, you know, sort of pitting it against the all out independence option and complete centralized government, when actually there's a continuum within that, and the electorate normally falls certainly within devolution and towards independence. So it's just something to be very, very careful of and very mindful of, because this will not be the last policy area that we see these types of interventions on.
Yeah. Well,
It makes me think, this is a question I'm posing to both of you, by vetoing, putting hurdles in front of, or like making a lot of this legislation, it almost is like a line item veto where they can veto whatever, whether it makes sense or not. It seems like the people of Scotland voted for politicians who were elected on a manifesto, right? And as the Scottish government rightfully tries to enact all the things on the manifestos, the UK government is saying no, and then saying, look at what you're wasting your money on. So every piece of legislation, everything, and not, you know, without with disregard for, this is what people voted for. And they'll say, look at the S&P, they don't care. Look at the Greens, they're incompetent, blah, blah, blah. None of that. I mean, putting forward legislation that was on your manifesto that got you elected is what a government should do. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting a little bit too conspiracy theorist, but it seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that there.
And I think... Oh, sorry, Ingunio.
No, no, I was just going to say on various things in there, and certainly GRR, that was a huge majority. It wasn't just the SNP and the Greens that voted that through. You know, and then they turn around and try and say, oh, it was just them and nobody really wanted it. And...
Yeah, I think the Tories like to use, like I was saying, that it's almost like, oh, the Scottish government's wasting money, or, you know, they're doing this when it's unpopular or it's controversial policies, and it's really just trying to get people to perhaps withdraw support or see the Scottish government as a quote-unquote waste of money. And I think this is the kind of narrative that they're trying to build, because ultimately the Tories would want to have the most centralised state ever, no devolution, limited powers for local authorities. You know, you've seen them starting to roll back on like the voting mechanisms for London mayoral elections, which will go to first past the post, things like that. So it's really, really concerning, and people really, really need to be mindful of that. And this is Labour's job, in my opinion, as the party of devolution. Of course, the Greens and SNP, Liberal Democrats, also should be banging this drum that it's devolution is extremely, extremely important. We've seen the mitigation of a lot of policies at the Scottish Parliament. I would like them to go further, of course, but there is that. And if we start to see more rolling back of devolution, we'll start to see more damaging policies actually get to people.
Unfortunately, in practice, what we're seeing from Labour is saying, we could manage this better. So they're not defending devolution. They're a lot of Labour has largely supported these manifesto promises and like GRR and things like that. But they are taking the ultimate peak Labour approach of, we'll see, we would be able to get it done better with that magical thinking that they have.
Yeah, Labour asking for people to vote Labour for a Labour government is just is their go-to. And okay, fine, that makes sense if you're the Labour Party and you're saying that. But when Labour's in government, could you not just do the sort of middle of the road mediocre policies that we seen during 1997? And certainly, could you do something about the voting system while you're in there? Could you prevent us from being facing, you know, the brunt of these Tory policies? Okay, that's great, Labour government, for what, for the next 10 years? And then it goes to Tory again. It's just, you know, for me, it's not a good enough sell. And it's one of the fundamental reasons why I do support Scottish independence, you know, because it's Labour Tory when it comes to Westminster. And it's just not helpful at all for the people of Scotland. So please, Labour, okay, we know you want people to vote Labour. That's fine. That's your job as you know, the Labour Party to drum up votes. But please, let's call it and protect devolution, but also look at ways of how we can protect the electorates going forward when you do become the next government at Westminster.
That'd be good. And getting a change to the voting system. I would like to, very much desperate to see it happen, but I don't know if it's going to, because they benefit out of the system at the moment, so why kill it off for themselves? We've got some kind of proportional representation in the Scottish Parliament, and I think that's made it a far more rounded institution, to use that word, than Westminster. And certainly with at the moment with the Scottish Greens and the SNP, there is far more collaboration. And I think that's where you get, I mean, obviously you can go completely the other way and go to like Italy was for a number of years with lots of wee coalition governments that never lasted. But in general, I mean, well, the last one in the UK when we had the Lib Dems in with the Tories, they did actually curb an awful lot of things the Tories wanted to do at that time. Unfortunately, they've done them now, but when you get that kind of rounded thing and people have got to talk to different people rather than just going, oh no, we're in power, absolute power here. I mean, we've got an 80-seat majority, we're just going to do that without consulting and trying to get, you know, people on your side. And you know, I can hope.
Yeah, I think also that the, you know, talking about devolution particularly and voting practices, we've seen voting systems rather, you can even see that at local authority level, that where most of the councils in Scotland, last time I checked, were under no overall control. So there is some form of agreements, coalitions, things like that to operate councils. And in my opinion, I think that's a positive thing. Of course, I would rather that coalition did never included the Tories. But, you know, that is just the way that the some of the outcomes were. So, yeah, it's interesting to see that in Scotland, because it's funny when you look at the local election results and sort of these regional votes and mayoral elections, that they're not STV, they're not, you know, single transferable vote or EMS, it's first past the post. So it's just, to me, is frankly crazy that is still the case.
Well, I mean, the result in that last Westminster election proves it for me. I mean, they get less than 50% of people that voted. What was it, 46 or something? I can't remember, something around that.
For the Tories, the outcome, I think it was just like 46%, roughly. Yeah.
And they got a majority of 80 seats.
80 seats, I mean, yeah.
That's flabbergasting, isn't it? Less than half the vote.
That's like American level, presidential election level bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we've seen, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg admitting that, you know, bringing in the ID for votes was some sort of attempt to gerrymander. And so we're seeing the Tories are completely desperate. Their support has collapsed. I think it's pretty much a given that there will be, Labour will be the next biggest party at the next general election. And it's just at times like this, you just need to pay very close attention to minor changes in policy when it comes to voting and how powers are being delivered across the institutions right across the UK.
But one of the things, well, I think that the Tories are good at, unfortunately, is that, you know, that wee bit by wee bit and chipping away at things to eventually get somewhere. And with the kind of media-wise as well, all these wee things they're doing to Scotland at the moment in the Scottish Parliament, you know, that's, again, a build-up. It's not just a big slam at something. It's a wee bit here and then another wee bit and another wee bit. And unfortunately, they tend to be good at that.
Well, it's democracy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Little by little.
The Tories, they play a long game. Very, very long game. And it's like, it's almost like a nail file. Just slowly, slowly taken away, you know, and inflicting degradation to democratic institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
So, there's a few things to mention in the next topic. It could just be one, but a few things come up. So I think just maybe Scottish-related things, or more Scottish-related things in Westminster. but in particular, kind of rule-breaking and so on. So the first one being Margaret Ferrier and the no vote. Not a vote being taken on whether to suspend her for 3 days, 30 days or not, and then consequently don't have to worry about any by-election at the moment. But you know, people saying in the background, backroom deals with what was going on, and that if that happened to her, it could set a precedent, and then that might go on to other politicians who have been caught and fined for doing things in the pandemic. And mainly mentioned has been Boris Johnson, but of course Rishi Sunak was fined as well, wasn't he?
He was.
So do you think there's shenanigans in there, or was it just because there wasn't enough MPs to give it the nod? You think there's something more to it?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar enough with this. So it was, she was appealing it. Remember, I can't vote in Westminster. I can't, you know, I work at Scottish Parliament. So paying a little bit of attention to the council and what's going on at Holyrood is kind of as far as I can go. It does seem like, I mean, Margaret Ferrier's breaking of the rules came at a very bad time in the COVID pandemic and the public backlash and everything. I think it was, you know, I'm not going to say it was well-deserved by her, but it seems proportionate. And, you know, so is there a recall petition going forward now?
Well, no, it has to be.
Or not yet.
Voted that she gets the 30-day suspension, and then if that's voted for, they can go to the electorate in her constituency.
I thought they already voted for the 30-day suspension for some reason.
No, it was.
How long are they going to talk about this before it happens?
Well, exactly. Yes. I think just looking at it here, it says Ferrier spoke in Parliament awaiting the results of the COVID test in September 2020. So it's going to be 3 years roughly by the time it either happens or doesn't happen.
I mean, how mad must she be seeing all this Boris Johnson stuff and the Partygate stuff? Like, I'd be raging.
Yeah, I think this particular story has gone on for far too long. The fact that this is, I understand there was the criminal justice side of things had to play out, and then obviously it returns to Parliament and it's an internal process. The fact it's been delayed again until after recess, I think it could be sometime after the 5th of June that this vote will take place. If MPs vote to not suspend her for 30 days, that is really, really concerning, in my opinion. The electorate should have an opportunity to have their say. But bear in mind, we're about 12 months away from a general election, likely. So by the time that this goes through, these processes seem to take far too long, right? This is the reality, you know. We can speculate why it was delayed. I think that's, you know, a side argument. I think that this process needs to run its course. The MPs need to do the right thing and suspend Margaret Ferrier so that there can be a recall petition, and then it's handed over to the constituency as it should be. And the only reason we've ended up in this situation is because Margaret Ferrier didn't resign. And I think that this is the biggest point that stands with us. I mean, when the news broke, I think it was a couple of days later that the whip was withdrawn from Margaret Ferrier. And Nicola Sturgeon had, you know, basically said that Margaret Ferrier should resign. Margaret Ferrier chose not to resign, kept on as an independent MP. And I know I used to live in the constituency that Margaret Ferrier represents. Mm-hmm. And from what I can see and what I've heard from social media, obviously, you know, David lives there as well. People are furious about this. Really, really angry, and rightfully so. And I believe that the mechanism should be enacted so that that constituency can decide who should represent them at Westminster. And the longer it goes on, it just becomes more and more frustrating. And if MPs choose not to suspend Margaret Ferrier for her actions, then that just layers on even more frustration, I think, for the constituents. So really, I just would like an ideal world where there will be a by-election in Rutherglen and Hamilton West, and the easiest way for that to happen would be if Margaret Ferrier was to resign. So we don't have to go through all these steps. So, you know, it's that's what should happen. You know, it needs to be handed back to the constituents, and the quickest way that could happen is if Margaret Ferrier resigns.
Yeah, she hasn't done it so far, so perhaps not, unfortunately. Another wee bit of a scandal, one of the bits, in that there was four MPs that were putting motoring driving penalty charges on their expenses and being paid that by Parliament. So there was three Tories and one SNP MP for Angus, Dave Dugan. And overall, I couldn't find exactly what his were, but I think the four of them together were, says, over £1,000. So they're getting some kind of driving penalty charge and just claiming it back from the public.
So I've tried to figure out what's up with the Dave Dugan one. He had denied expensing the fine, but he expensed some delay or something. Basically had said, I want to remedy this. I think that this takes to a larger point. Like, why was that approved in the first place? Mm-hmm. So working at Scottish Parliament, there are a lot. Like, to use your expenses, they have to be approved and be found to be to meet the standards. And I'm just wondering why are they not doing that at Westminster? So Angus Robertson is the MSP for my local branch, and he used to be an MP. He was talking about, oh, you have to go through these things if you're sending anything, if you're sending letters or contact cards out. You know, you have this budget for engagement from the Scottish Parliament, and they will go and pick through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure it's not partisan, that it is doing parliamentary work. He said when it was in Westminster, you could put anything through, and then sometimes you get a bill if somebody calls you out, which is like, what kind of a system is that?
Yeah. So I found a wee bit what you were saying about delay. So it was the congestion charge for the ultra-low emissions zone. And so he didn't pay it on time, which resulted in an increased charge, which was claimed and approved by IPSA, whatever it is, parliamentary, etc.
Yeah, I think one of my key things about this one is, how do you think that you have the right to do that? I think the attitude is the issue. Mm-hmm. To even go ahead with that process. Obviously, I agree with Kat that these processes should be robust, that things like this don't happen. And if you are, you know, if we're going to take that at face value of what Dave Dugan has said, then, you know, because you have not gone ahead and paid a charge within time, you're then being charged additional for not meeting the deadline, and you're just putting that through as expenses, I don't believe that that is acceptable, particularly within the context of a cost of living crisis. I mean, you know, even cost of living crisis aside, to believe that that is within your right to do that, it just does not sit well with me. And I believe that the SNP should absolutely investigate this. And you know, I don't know what the outcome should be. I'm not here to say, you know, Dave Dugan should resign or whatever it is. But I think there needs to be some kind of investigation here, and then some real standards put on the SNP MP group at Westminster to make sure that these things are absolutely unacceptable. Because not only is that Dave Dugan's actions, which are infuriating, but potentially, you know, believing that he can go ahead and do this, but it's actually putting the SNP MP group into disrepute. And we know that, as we've spoken about a lot before, that the mainstream media generally is not sympathetic towards the SNP. So he is potentially putting his MP group into disrepute. So there definitely needs to be some kind of investigation and standards and communication sent out to the public, to so that people are aware of what happened, what didn't happen, and what the standards will be going forward, because that kind of attitude as an MP is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Especially the kind of pay that an MP brings in. Like, sorry, right? You make a right? lot of money as an MP. Just because you can get away with it doesn't mean you should. And that's Kat's momming advice for the episode.
I would also like to know, just on the kind of the side of it, why was he driving a car in London through the ultra low emission zone? If he's an MP from Angus, but I mean, public transport in London is, you know,
public transport in my London.
Car through the obviously the very centre of London. But that's a completely side issue.
No, but it's a really, really important point, because public transport in London is phenomenal. And you know, however Dave is deciding to travel down to London, you know, whether it hopefully by, you know, using rail network or whatever it is, you can get to Westminster relatively easy on public transport, and it's relatively cheap, and it would be much cheaper for you for the public purse. So yeah, no, it's a side point, but it's actually really, really important that the MPs are not just taking the piss.
Well, as we know, Margaret Fairley reduces the train.
Yeah, we know that.
Oh, that was a good one.
Any other dodgy dealings in Westminster you want to talk about?
Yeah. Boris Johnson and the lawyers one is a really, really big one. Because I can't remember the exact figure. So basically, Boris Johnson is going through this COVID inquiry and using UK government lawyers, right? Which is, you know, a cost for the public purse again. And to get legal aid in England, it's different than Scotland, that your income needs to be below £12,000, right, for you to get all-out support with legal aid. Boris Johnson, obviously worth a lot of money, a lot of income from various different jobs and whatever's going on, and decides to essentially take legal aid. I think it's absolutely disgraceful. I know now, I believe that Boris Johnson, after more evidence has been handed over to the inquiry, I think around diary entries about potential more rule breaking and I think it was in Down Street, but also at Chequers. I believe that he no longer uses the public lawyers because of that. But, you know, lol. But yeah, the fact that again, this just comes down to entitlement and attitude, right? So Boris Johnson, ex-prime minister, you know, whatever, believes that it's within his right to use public money to go through this process. I think it's absolutely disgusting and disgraceful, but unfortunately not surprising.
Is he now, the Tory party is paying for his legal fees, are they not? I read that.
What, now?
Yeah.
Quite possibly. Wouldn't surprise me.
I saw, did any of you see the Sky News person who interviewed him at the airport? Like, that was a phenomenal piece of journalism, because you could see how angry Boris Johnson was at not getting his way. right? Like, he was just furious. He was like, why did these government lawyers turn over my diary entries? How dare they? You know what I mean? How dare they act in the public interest and not my own? It was quite the scene. I try not to ever listen to Boris Johnson speak, but that was worth it.
Yeah, and this just comes down to the attitude again, doesn't it? That you know, someone being challenged, someone, you know, and you can see when Boris Johnson sat in front of that committee when he was being grilled on some of these points, he does not handle criticism of his behaviour, attitudes, very well at all, and I think that just comes from a lifetime of privilege.
Mm-hmm. And you can just imagine him there as a wee boy. And sort of throwing whatever out the pram if he didn't like what he got, and been mollycoddled afterwards.
Yeah, his parents not actually paying attention to what he needed, and just shutting him up. That's peak Tory to me.
Yeah, and being a school teacher, you can see sort of different types, or maybe not different types, but. Certainly make it a good go at how young people have been brought up and to how they react to things or being told off about something, you know, and, you know, relate that to what they do at home and how they get on. And, you know, if you get sort of, all right, they go, and then they go, and look really sad, going, no, sorry, you're getting told off. You're not being told, oh, no, you didn't do it wrong. Well, there you go, there's a biscuit. You know, and think Boris was definitely treated like that. You know, didn't do anything wrong, always got away with it.
Now I'm paranoid about how my kids act at school. But actually, I worry about that. And that's probably what keeps me from being a terrible parent. Well, that and just liking my children.
Right, we move on to our last topic, right, on a lighter note that we have been on. So, recently reported, there is Dundee and Angus College have set up a degree course on gaming. Now, Dundee is down as the UK gaming capital already, and I think Abertay University do a lot of it as well. And they have set this up. One of the lecturers is a FIFA pro player, and is 22, and is a lecturer in there as well. So, as you might imagine, sort of a lot of younger people even being the lecturers in that. But they've got lots of plans. It's not just a degree on how to sit there and play games, although that being part of it, they're sort of saying it's a wide thing, and that look at digital marketing, event management. One of the things that mentioned a few times in the report is about the well-being of players and people in it, how to look after that, and also coaching as well. And they say that the students would be encouraged to use the gym and the pool and to get out there and not just be sitting and twiddling their thumbs around on that. So if that's something, I think that fairly big happening in Scotland. I think that's something that should be done wider than that. Is that something that, because me being an old person, I'm not sure how big the gaming industry is. I know it's quite big, but apart from that, you know, is it? Do you guys think it's something that will keep going?
I'm quite confused because I really thought that this was a program for game design, which I thought great, you know, but it's not. I'm going to be a downer. Just call me David today. Because psychology, game theory is part of like political science and psychology. Event planning is already a thing. I guess maybe they want to build a community and they think it'll make, you know, build some excitement. But to me, it just seems like branding. It seems unnecessary. Like, people can already do these things. But the gaming industry has money. So, I don't know. Good luck to you. Good luck on getting a job. I hope you have a good time at uni, if that's your major. I don't really have anything against it. I just, in a cost of living crisis, it's kind of like, oh, cool.
I read quite a bit about this one because I find it really interesting. Obviously, I work in higher education. Don't know anything about gaming, so I have no real... last time that I had a console, it was a PlayStation 1, so that was quite some time ago. But actually, I think this is really positive, right? So this is about engaging with people and what their interests are, right? So when I was... So this is like pre-pandemic, because I had the first years in HRM, right? And we were doing some of the you could call them drier subjects. So you're talking about, you know, pay and reward and all these different things. But we came up with a really good assignment. So we're looking at gender pay gap as one of the key cruxes of the question. But some people were really struggling to engage with it. But when we started talking about what their interests were, so people are really interested in football, for example, I'm like, there's a massive pay gap right there. So, you know, students are finding where their interests are that are linked to other things. So if we're talking about events management and things like that too, linking with this, that's fantastic, because the transferable skills that come out of all of these things is really, really positive. And if you've got like community building around people that are really, really interested in gaming, and there's a lot of sort of spokes that come off that of different subject areas that they can really get involved in, that's what you want. And I think when you go to uni, you really want to be deeply passionate about what it is that you're doing, right? Because that's how I've ended up, you know, going ahead and doing a PhD in one very small area within work, employment and organisation. But it's just about, it's that pulling factor, and it definitely is branding, right? Because most degree levels you go into, so like psychology is one as well, criminology is another, right? So it's very much like, oh, this is what you're going to learn about, but you also have to learn about stats, you have to learn about this, you have to learn about that. So there will be loads, yeah, there will be loads and loads of these types of things built into these degrees. There'll be loads of transferable skills in there. And do you know what, Dundee, I lived there for about 3 years. I loved it, great city. Abertay is just so far ahead when it comes to game design, computing, computer science, all these different things, right? And Dundee and Angus College becoming part of that story, I think, is a great thing, because you know, when you get institutions that get their little specialisms and they really, really build on it, they pull in research and development into that area, it's a really, really positive thing. So I'm really interested to see where this goes. And even though I have no knowledge or real interest in gaming itself, I think these types of degrees are really, really important, because I think a lot of people make links to going to university and you know, getting that career, getting that job, when university should be about learning, and it should be about learning these transferable skills, critical thinking and presentation skills, all these different things. So these types of degrees will incorporate that, and it's a great thing. So there you go. That's my positive spin. David is not here today.
Okay, Brian, you've convinced me. David indeed is not here. So you've had me buy in, because when I think about it, academia is not far behind me, and it probably could use a different model.
Oh, so, yeah.
Good luck, gamers.
Well, certainly academia is a long way behind me. And I hope it's changed from 1978 I started and 1983 I finished. So
some changes.
Yeah, crikey. But that's 40 years ago now, isn't it?
Also, getting that message across to people who are in high school and things like that, who are really, really into gaming, that there is the gaming and the game design and computer science is all sort of interlinked and things like that. I think I'm actually quite excited for these people who love this type of thing. It's good to see these types of degrees coming up. People, you know, people slag off like Mickey Mouse degrees. That was a kind of slating word that was used about 5-10 years ago about trying to devalue what universities do. But these types of things are great.
We always called it a degree in underwater basket weaving, which seems like it would be quite hard, actually.
Really difficult.
Yeah. But I agree that you shouldn't have to use your free tuition on something that, because usually if the state wants it, it's business or venture capitalism or economics. So
you can find all our podcasts at leftungagged.org, as well as written articles. And you can sign up for our free newsletter. Catch the Talking Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. And if you have anything you want us to talk about, tweet us at _ungagged, # Holyrood Ungagged, or email us at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Holyrood Ungagged in the subject line. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you use. You can also join our Discord community. Have fun, be good, and be lucky.
Yeah. Right. So maybe the title of this episode is David's Not Here, Actually. A happy ending.
David's not here. It's a happy ending.
We love you, David.
Yeah. We love you, David.
We love you, David.